This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. Late next month, the state's senators and representatives will be returning to Raleigh to begin their next legislative session. The new year could bring a different kind of leadership to the legislature, and there are also a number of issues that need to be addressed. Electronic voting is certainly going to be on the minds of many. And also on January 1st, several new laws are going to be taking effect because of actions the legislature took last session. And to help us look ahead at the coming session, we've invited our own Capitol reporter, Laura Leslie, back to the show. Welcome again, Laura.
Hi, Melinda. Thanks for having me.
Hi there. Well, over in the State House, when they get together in January, there is a bit of housekeeping to be taken care of first.
They have to elect their leadership. And each caucus, of course, chooses its own leaders. And then the entire House will vote on who they want to be the speaker. But, of course, if you're the Democrats in the majority this year, then it's going to be your pick, more than likely. And the person that they picked unanimously earlier this week was Speaker Jim Black. Now, as a lot of people know, we've had a co-speakership for the last 2 years, which is really unprecedented. People from other states look at me funny when I tell them about the co-speakership.
Because it was such an odd thing 2 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it was, nobody anticipated it, but it worked out fairly well. But last time they did that because they had the House split down the middle. This time they don't have a split. The Democrats are in the majority. So, you know, there's a lot of talk about having a sole speaker this year, Jim Black, and the kind of changes that that's likely to bring in the Assembly.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, that means Richard Morgan, who is the Republican and had been the Republican co-speaker last time around. He may have been expecting to continue to share power, but that doesn't look like it's going to happen.
Well, there's a couple ways to look at that. One thing, Republican Richard Morgan hasn't given up yet. He keeps telling me he's in talks with Speaker Black and they're going to make that decision next month. But there's other ways to share power besides a co-speakership, and that is a coalition, and that's a term that Speaker Black uses a lot and fairly loosely. But what it basically means is that you hand out some of the powerful committee chairmanships to the other party, and in return you get their cooperation on legislation that you want to see move forward, and that's probably what we're going to see.
Mm-hmm. But it would not necessarily be shared as equally as it was last time around, because last time around, was it not the case that if co-speaker Black didn't like something, they didn't take it up? If Richard Morgan didn't like something as co-speaker, they didn't take it up. Now, he's not going to quite have that veto.
No, and so that means that we're going to see some issues move forward this year, more than likely, that we didn't see move forward in the last session. One thing that Speaker Black said Tuesday that he has been talking to members about already is raising the cigarette tax. That's an issue that's come up, and a lot of people have said, I don't know why they don't, because we have one of the lowest cigarette taxes in the country. But it's an issue that hasn't come to the floor because somebody didn't want it to. But now he's got the ability to move that forward, and he's already talking to R.J. Reynolds and Philip Morris about it. So there's another issue that a lot of people want to see come up again, and that's the lottery. It comes up every year, but this year it may move forward a little faster because we don't have that sort of double veto power going on at the top.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, of course, the governor has been just really wanting to have that get through. Yeah. Now, electronic voting. That has certainly gotten a lot of press in the weeks since the election, or shall we say the non-election of the agriculture commissioner, because that race is still up in the air. The two candidates have been separated by a few thousand votes, and there were 4,000 votes missing in Carteret County because of a malfunction with the electronic machine there. Carteret County voters are essentially going to decide this race, and it comes back to that. Beyond that, though, what is the state doing about electronic voting to make sure that this kind of thing doesn't happen again?
Well, there was a study commission in the legislature that was appointed a couple of years ago to sort of look at it, but it wasn't really doing a lot, of course. After November 2nd in Carteret County, and Carteret County wasn't the only county that had problems with electronic voting this year. There were, I think, 5 counties that had some irregularities with electronic voting. So they've actually appointed a commission that's going to do something, Joint Select Legislative Committee. And it's a couple of legislators, the head of the state elections board, and some other folks who are in the know. They're going to go through a bunch of different systems, learn about the pros and cons and what the possible hazards are, and then decide what the better systems are, set some state standards, and then recommend those systems to the counties. And there's also some money available because, I mean, these systems obviously aren't cheap, and a lot of counties can't really afford to upgrade their systems. But the federal Help Americans Vote Act also included some federal funding, which the state can then use to help counties pay for those upgrades to the approved equipment.
How is that different from what we've had in place to this point, which we did a program several months back about electronic voting, and we were told at that point that the state had criteria for what would pass muster as an adequate electronic voting machine? Are we talking about a higher standard being set here?
I think November 2nd proved that adequate wasn't adequate. And I think the state is taking a very serious look at that. One of the things that they're most interested in, especially after Carteret County, is going back to the idea of a voter-verified paper record. Because when you have votes get lost, like they were in Carteret County, we're now looking at having to have a special election for those people. But if there had been a paper record, it wouldn't have been necessary. Mm-hmm. We could have just gone to the paper records and done the count like that. Mm-hmm. And so,
and a paper record being perhaps when you go to cast your ballot, the machine, you know, catches your paper that you might have written your ballot on, like an Optiscan machine.
Like an Optiscan, or even, I mean, it wouldn't. Well, some people say that they really want what's called a voter verified, which means that you'd get the opportunity after casting your vote to look through a little window at a piece of paper to prove that your vote registered the way that you wanted it to register. But over and above that, there's the problem of accountability. There's audits, there's recounts. And so whether or not voters even verify that piece of paper, there needs to be a piece of paper, even if it's just a printout.
At the end of the day, that stays in the machine.
Right. Yeah. And that can be hauled out if the machine has a problem. Because what we saw happen is what people who have been in favor of paper records have been saying is going to happen. We're kind of, I hate to say this, but the electoral poster child for the U.S. in this sense, because a lot of states are arguing about what if, and what if happened to us? It happened in Carteret County.
Mm-hmm. Because the machines there just stopped accepting votes at a certain point. Its software, or I guess its memory was full.
Its memory was full, and it was actually a user mistake. Nobody's sure at this point whether the user that was the problem was on our end or on Unilect's end, the maker of the machine.
User, not the individual voter, but
no.
the county that was running it.
Right. It was either, there was a misunderstanding about how many votes it would actually hold. And everybody says, of course, it wasn't me, it was the guy on the other end. But regardless of what it was, the fact remains that the state needs to be able to do more to help these counties manage the technology and troubleshoot the technology. And so some people are saying, maybe the state needs to take over elections. You know, maybe we need to have, at the very least, districts, but perhaps state supervision of all these machines. And if this committee that we were discussing is able to come up with one or two systems that they can recommend to the counties and that the counties can get, then the state can have IT people there. They can have help desk people there who could help to avoid this kind of problem in
because
the future.
Currently, as you're saying, Laura, it's a county-by-county thing. Each county decides which machine it's going to get. That passes, at least up till this past year, some kind of criteria. But if we had maybe one or two, why not just even have one? Is anybody pitching that idea that the state decides one machine across the state? And
that's what we're going to have. Well, you know, part of that is money, because it costs a lot of money to replace voting machines. And you have to train people and you have to, you know, get people used to and educated on the new machines. But, you know, I suspect we're probably going to hear that proposal come up as this goes on, because, I mean, these systems, if you've ever seen them, they're very, very tremendously different from each other, and they do very different things. And it is really, I think, difficult, as was highlighted November 2nd, when you're operating on 100 different counties, 100 different systems, to make sure that everybody's vote gets counted and that voters know that their vote gets counted. That's the real issue, because if people don't believe in it, they're not going to vote.
Right, right. It has to inspire confidence.
Right.
Yeah. Well, before the legislature gets back into session this year, at which point it, you know, may look in this issue before 2 years from now, the next time there's an election, that we have to have those machines working. When the legislature gets back, even before then, there are some new laws that they worked on last time around that are going to take hold.
The biggest one that's made the most news is the booster seat. Have you heard about this one?
Yes, vaguely, but tell us some more.
It used to be if your child was five or under, you had to have the child restrained in an appropriate seat. Well, this year they passed a law saying making it 8 years old, 8 or 80 pounds. And the reason for that is because lap belts, the way they're designed in cars, if you're a small person, the lap belt goes right across your neck. And there's a lot of injuries that have been caused by the fact that belts just don't fit kids properly. So Senator Bill Purcell, who is a former pediatrician, well, probably still a pediatrician, was one of the sponsors of this bill. And the aim is to get kids up off the seat to where the lap and shoulder belts will fit them appropriately. So these seats cost between $20 and $40. They're available pretty much anywhere a baby seat would be. But they're going to be required by law as of January 1st. And you could face a ticket, $25 ticket, you know, if your kid between 5 and 8 is not in a booster seat as of January 1st.
Can you just use the old booster seat you had, or do you have to have a bigger one for the potentially larger kid?
I suppose that probably depends on the kid. But, but you know, this says, I think a lot of people were sort of unaware of this. And so they've been doing, Jim Long, Commissioner of Insurance, Jim Long, has been doing a lot of promotional stuff around the state to get people aware of the fact that this change is coming. And there are some exceptions, like, you know, if you're in a car that just doesn't have shoulder belts, well, you can't do a lot about that, you know. But by and large, they're really serious about this, and they are going to be out looking on mm-hmm. January 1st.
Mm-hmm. Well, and at the other age of the at the other end of the life cycle, we have a new law regarding the nursing homes. And there are going to be checks on the people who work there?
Right. Well, they already do criminal history checks on a lot of long-term care workers and residential care workers. But one of the problems was is that the federal systems and the state systems just weren't talking to each other very effectively. So you could do a great, you know, criminal background check on somebody in North Carolina, but if they had a history in Tennessee, you're out of luck. And so one of the things that a lot of states, including North Carolina, has taken up over the last few years is finding ways to smooth the process between the federal and the state to make that information get back to the people who are doing the hiring so that they're able to find out that information instead of sort of, you know, and basically you're shooting in the dark right now, you know, when you're looking up somebody's state criminal history. Mm-hmm. So this is something that's going to go into effect on January 1st, and it simply makes it easier for that information to flow, remove some of the privacy barriers, and I think it's going to – I think operators of, you know, nursing homes and long-term care facilities are going to be very relieved when this goes into effect.
Mm-hmm. And finally, just before we go, there's going to be a new law regarding meth labs.
Right. Well, actually, a lot of the meth laws have already gone into effect, but what the well, this is backed pretty firmly by the Attorney General Roy Cooper, but the legislature passed it. But it makes it, for example, an aggravated felony to be manufacturing meth when there's children around, for
because
example.
Of the chemicals that are in the air.
Right. And it also institutes some standards so that when police go into a meth scene, when they clean it up, what they have to do to clean it up because it is so toxic.
Okay. Well, Laura Leslie, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Laura Leslie is WUNC's Capitol reporter. Just ahead, we'll meet David Terrenoir, a Durham-based author who's just published his first novel, Beneath a Panamanian Moon. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. Durham's David Terrenoir is a multi-talented guy. By all accounts, he's a terrific blues harmonica player, a former actor, one-time advertising copywriter, ghostwriter, and now he can claim to be a novelist. His debut novel, Beneath a Panamanian Moon, just came out, and he joins us here in the studio to talk about that and a lot more. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for being here. Well, I do want to talk about your novel a little bit first.
Sure.
It features a main character, John Harper. He plays the piano, and he is increasingly a reluctant spy.
Yes, he is.
Now, is he based on someone real?
Nobody that I could tell you about.
Okay. You'd have to shoot me, right?
Yes. No. I started off writing it with just this voice in my head. I originally set the novel in 1968, and the first line of the novel was, I joined the army to beat the draft. And, he gets sucked into being a spy because he's a piano player, and a good piano player in a room kind of disappears. So they see this talent that he has, that he disappears into a room, and since he also is playing piano for a lot of functions like State Department functions and that sort of thing, he overhears things, as well as he has a tendency to bed young women who are married to influential men.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
now, does this bear any resemblance to your life?
Again, not that I could tell you about.
Okay.
My wife is listening. I've been happily married for 25 years. She knows all my skeletons. So, no, actually, it's not. His sense of humor is mine.
Okay.
I think I told your producer yesterday, I don't intentionally write funny. It's just that it kind of comes out that way. And in fact, the editor took about a third of the humor out of the book. He said, kept saying, "Oh, it gets in the way of the suspense. You can't. This, it's a funny scene, but it just gets in the way of the suspense." So I've toned it down quite a bit.
But you've had to deal with editors and people telling you how to write this book, uh-huh. as I understand, for some time.
For some time. Yes.
How long have you been working on this?
I wrote the first version of this 11 or 12 years ago. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it, like I said, it was set in 1968, and I finished it in about 9 months, got an agent, they tried to sell it, and everybody said, we can't sell anything that has anything to do with that time period, because there was a glut of Vietnam books. And even though it doesn't take place in Vietnam, there was just a lot of problem selling anything in 1968. So another editor suggested I rewrite it to 1981 during the Reagan 80s in Central America, because there's a lot of stuff happening in there. By the time I finished the rewrite, nobody cared about the Reagan 80s. Oh, okay, so now you don't have to hit me with a stick too many times. I figured I'll just put this in kind of a generic present, and that way I'll avoid all this. So,
mm-hmm. So you were an advertising copywriter
for a while. Yeah, I was stereotype copywriter, novel in the desk, you know, keep talking about writing that great American novel, and never got around to it. Mm-hmm. And I lost my job. And my wife said, well, come on, Sparky. You always talked about writing a novel. Here you go. Step up to the plate, Jack.
Yeah. So now, you had no formal training.
None.
About writing. You didn't go for
Master of Fine Arts. No, none of that. What I did when I decided, well, you know, she's right, I better put up or shut up. I was 43, and I had talked about writing novels since I was 13, so that's 30 years of hot air. So what I did is I took apart books that I really admired, writers like Elmore Leonard, Carl Hiaasen, people that I enjoyed reading. So I took them apart like a clock, and just to see how they worked, because I had no idea how many words are in a novel. How do you know these
did
things?
Did you count them?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I did. And there's an average novel is 80 to 100,000 words. Mm-hmm. So
deconstruct Elmore Leonard for us, because I've read him a lot, but I've never quite analyzed it like that.
The thing that I learned from Elmore Leonard, and I have to tell you, I have stood in line to meet two authors, and they are Elmore Leonard and Carl Hiaasen. The thing I learned from Elmore Leonard was, if you have two people in a conversation, you have two very different agendas in that scene. And you should be aware of what each person wants out of that scene. Because otherwise, and there's also the third person, there's the writer. The writer wants something in that scene, too. He wants to forward the plot, etc. But if you're not true to what your characters want, the scene is nothing but, you know, flaccid, and it's just pushing forward the story, and you're not being true to the people in the story. So that's what I learned from Elmore Leonard. If you have two people talking, you've got two very different agendas, and you should be aware of those.
It's always struck me about Elmore Leonard's writing, compared to some other very, very popular books that might get sold at airports a lot about law and lawyers, that his dialogue stands out.
Oh, yeah.
Because he'll have these characters. If you should leave the page and come back to it, you know who is who in a line talking, because the voices are very, very clear.
He's great at that.
Otherwise, but when you talked about the narrator, I wonder sometimes if we want to make the conversation mesh as a nice piece, and sometimes conversations happen in disjointed ways.
Oh, big chunks and stuff. Yeah, I used to, when I was a copywriter, one of the things that I do well is I write radio, radio spots pretty well. And I've had clients who say, oh, but they wouldn't say that. That's not a complete sentence. And, well, hey, who talks in complete sentences? Nobody does. And the worst were former English majors. And I am a former English major. So, yeah, I got a lot of that. But that's a sentence fragment. Yes. Yes, indeed, it is. And that's a noun. And that's an adjective.
Right. Yeah. So, and you say you also analyzed Carl Hiaasen.
Carl Hiaasen actually gave me liberty. He said, Miles Davis, if I can jump back here, we'll talk about music a bit. Miles Davis, what Miles Davis did for, or Charlie Parker, not Miles Davis, what Charlie Parker did for jazz is he freed us from melody. So when you played a solo, you didn't have to stick to the melody. What Carl Hiaasen has done for novelists is, if you're writing a suspense novel or a mystery or a thriller, you don't have to not be funny. You're allowed to be funny, and that was a huge weight off my shoulders, because I don't write like Raymond Chandler, and I don't think like John McDonald. I just don't. So when I read Carl Hiaasen, I said, I can do that, and because that's the way I think. It was a liberating thing. Yeah.
But you're not writing like Raymond Chandler, perhaps, but you still have chunks of noir in there
your book. Yeah, I can't help it. I'm just such a sucker for things like the Maltese Falcon, Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler. They're my grandfathers. They're just
together.
Yeah, they're the best. Mm-hmm. And I love this quote from Raymond Chandler because of my advertising background. He said that chess is the greatest waste of human intelligence outside of an ad agency.
Right. Well, you have I think it would be a Chandler-esque line in there that jumped out at me. And you were describing your character who lives in Washington.
Yes.
That's where he plays piano most of the time. And he is recruited to go to Panama.
Yes.
Because he had been in the military and they've recruited him to go there once again. He doesn't want to go, but he's basically forced to go there. And he arrives in Panama and he makes this comparison between having lived through summers in Washington, D.C., or you could say anywhere in the South, really, and how Panama is much more hot than that.
Yes.
But he talks about how even in Washington, D.C., where you'd walk out on a summer day and you could cut, you could cut the air for seat covers.
Yeah.
It was that thick.
Yeah, it's true. My daughter is dating a writer, unfortunately, and he read the book, and he said, the first thing he said, well, he mentioned there was a joke in there that he really liked, but then he said, there are so many similes. How do you write so many similes? And yeah, I probably overdo it with similes. I should pull back on those.
So you made your living for a while as writing ad copy for radio. What kind of commercials would you do?
This is a notorious, and everybody who hears this, who remembers these spots, will probably go, "Oh my God, he wrote those," and attack me with torches and pitchforks. I wrote. Just about 10, 12 years ago, I wrote EdStock 92, and it was a chain of appliance dealers here in North Carolina, and they every year they had 3 days in the Greensboro Coliseum. They would have this big thing, so the art director and I were trying to figure out, what are we going to do with this 3 days of big sale appliances and crap? So we came up, and the name of it is Ed Kelly, was the name of the chain. So we called it EdStock, and 3 days of peace, love, and electronics. They were, Ira David Wood, local actor, did one of the voices, and Roel Gorman did the other voice. So the radio spots were a guy who fell asleep in 1969 and has just woken up in 1994. And Ira David Wood played the really hyper 90s guy. Come on, wake up. Let's go. We got to go. We got to go to this thing, this big sale. And Roel Gorman was the 60s guy. Oh, man. And it was full of stupid jokes like the guy says, whoa, man, nice car. Says, yeah, it's got an airbag. Says, oh, man, you think this thing can fly? You know. A lot of stupid jokes like that. So, yeah, I did a lot of that stuff.
Imagine having a flashback in the Greensboro Coliseum.
Yeah. I have a lot of flashbacks about Greensboro. That was the last place I worked in a big ad agency, and it was one of the portals of hell.
Was it?
Yes, it was a bad place.
So you're not from North Carolina originally?
No, I grew up in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, Maryland, all over the place. Yeah. I moved here in 76, so I've been here a long time.
Right. And what made you move here?
I was living in Manhattan, and I was a short-order cook. And I was a successful short-order cook and a failed short fiction writer. And some friends of mine called me up and said, we're moving to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. You want to come? And I said, yeah, I think that would be nice. Yeah. So, and I moved here. I answered a classified ad for actors for the Duke Summer Theater, and I met my wife doing Duke Summer Theater, and never looked back. And it's been the greatest thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah. And so now you're writing. You've written this novel here.
Yes, I have.
Over a number of years, I see. You've given me this card in front. It's to the party that'll be happening in a month, I guess, for the opening, and it says 12 years, 5 major rewrites. 4 agents, 3 titles. What were the other titles beside Beneath a Panamanian Moon?
The first one was Monkey Man Blues. That was the first one. And then I changed it to Monkey Honeymoon. And my agent said, this is a big novel. He said, that title's not big enough. Mm. And I said, well, what about Beneath a Panamanian Moon? He said, oh, I love that. So,
Well, I also have to ask you about something else that appears on the book, and that's your name, David Ternoir.
Yes.
That translates in French to Black Earth.
Yes, it does.
Is that your real name?
Yes, it is my real name. You should hear a drill sergeant get a hold of it. Yeah.
What would it sound like with a DI?
I was called Tarantula, Toronado. Some would just look at my name and go, Alphabet. It was a tough name to live with all through public school. But now that I write mysteries, it's a great name. Yeah, I finally have learned to love it. My daughter's a singer, and I think she's very happy with it as well.
Oh, that's a great name for a singer.
Yeah.
That's a great name. What kind of songs does she do?
What kind of
music?
Quite frankly, I'd like her to sing more Torch stuff, but she sings pop. She likes people like, Alice, what's her name? I'm drawing a blank. A lot of the pop singers right now. She likes Sarah McLachlan, people like that.
Okay.
But she's just got a great set of pipes. Yeah. I mean, a great set of pipes.
Is this the daughter who's dating the writer that you'd
yes,
prefer he not be a writer?
Indeed. Oh, okay. And she's also dated musicians, which we're against too. But what are we going to do?
And that's because you are both.
Oh, yes. It's because I'm both. I wouldn't say that I'm the poster boy for mental health, so
but
not
I've
the
heard
most stable guy on the planet.
There are reports that have filtered back to us that, aside from all these other things that you've done, and now novelist among them, that you're a pretty darn good harmonica player, blues.
Well, I hope so. People seem to like what I do. It's my therapy. I do this every other week. I go to the Blue Bayou in Hillsboro. Every other Monday, please come out, hear us, and we play. And it's my Valium. It's a great thing. And my bar bill is a lot less than my therapy bill would be otherwise. Yeah. It's a great thing.
Where'd you learn to play harmonica?
I learned to play when I was in the service. It fit in my pack. So I always tell people that I had to get really good really fast because everybody around me had a loaded weapon.
And you talked about the drill instructor before. When
yes.
are you in the military? What branch of the military? Where
I got my draft notice in 1969, and I re-enlisted for a year because I, like the character in the novel, I joined up to beat the draft. You had some control of where you were going to go.
If you enlist for a year?
Yes.
Is that right?
Well, you had some control. That's what the recruiters tell you. Kids don't believe the recruiters. They lie.
So where'd you end up?
I ended up in Panama, which was the genesis of this novel. One of the things that I learned in Panama, I was 19 and very naive, just incredibly naive. One of the things that I learned was that I liked about Panama was that it is completely stripped. All the politics there are completely stripped of any PR surface. It's like an invisible clock. You can watch it happen. And, you know, like the cliche is, it's like watching sausage being made. It's nothing that you really want to look at.
And you're talking about the American politics and also the politics
of
the government
yes.
of Panama.
Oh, yeah. There's a great story. It's too long to go into here, but a great story about a cocaine smuggler into the States who was also a diplomatic courier that the United States said, come here, give us names, and we'll treat you really nice. Well, he ended up in a jail in Texas is what happened to him. But the Panamanian government heard this, and, the first thing they did, this gets them back. They kicked out all the Peace Corps workers. Wow. So you see things like that, and it really is like two kids on the playground, and they're just swatting at each other. And, of course, one kid is much bigger than the other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it was really fascinating to see this happen without all the spin, without all the spokespeople in the way of actually seeing what the real workings are. It was kind of frightening.
Yeah. And so that's where you set your novel.
Yes.
And again, you did not set it in 1960s Panama,
right.
And nor in 1980s. Is it in the modern time?
Yes, it is. It's if you check with the calendar, it actually took place last Christmas. But you don't have to know that.
But you've just told us.
Yes,
okay.
I have. Yeah. So this didn't really happen.
Yeah.
This is a fictional story. So.
Mm-hmm. What are you working on now?
I'm working on a book, a mystery set in Washington, D.C. in 1941. And that has been, I love research. So and I'm a bear for research, if there's a phone number in this novel that I give for a hotel, you can bet that in 1941 that was the hotel's phone number. Spent a lot of time at the Library of Congress. I got a really nice compliment from a research librarian there. She turned to I'm doggedly trying to find this information, and she turned to one of her colleagues and said, "He has the heart of a researcher." I love that. That was a great. What a great compliment. So it's set in 1941. It's a murder mystery about a guy who has spent 16 years on death row here in Central Prison. In North Carolina, who is gotten out of the prison by his daughter, who now works for the OSS.
Mm-hmm. So. Which is the precursor of the CIA?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which you can't tell me whether you worked for or not when you were in the military.
No, I can't tell you any of that. Because that I would be violating so many contracts.
Okay. But you do thank your draft board in the acknowledgments to this
Yes,
book.
I do. Yes, I do. It was an adventure. I don't know where I'd be had that not happened. It really opened my eyes to a lot of things, especially in the late 60s. I spent time in Guatemala, Bolivia, Colombia, Nicaragua, Honduras, and I never would have gotten to see those places because they're not exactly tourist spots. I never would have seen them. I never would have seen them on the level that I did. I never would have gotten to meet the people that I did, and it just broadened my horizon so much. I was a kid from Pennsylvania. What did I know? I knew nothing. And thankfully, it's one of the things that I think is a great thing about the military. And one of the upsides to the draft at the time is it brought in people that ordinarily would not have joined the service, and it got them out of their little insular world and showed them that there were people unlike them who actually were a lot like them. And it showed them places that they could go where they ordinarily wouldn't go. And it was a really mind-expanding experience. It was a great thing. So,
well, David Terrenoir, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm very pleased to be here.
David Terrenoir's novel, his first novel, is Beneath a Panamanian Moon. It's just been published. He'll be reading at Market Street Books in Chapel Hill on January 7th and at the Regulator in Durham on January 20th with special guest pianist Robert Griffin. Just ahead, eating out and staying in this weekend, some video pics and baking secrets just ahead on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penn Cava. Kelly Alexander is the far-flung correspondent and senior editor for Savour magazine. She lives in the Triangle and joins us regularly to talk about food and the culture of food, and she is with us again today. Hi there, Kelly.
Hi, Melinda.
Hi. Well, you have made it your mission since you moved to North Carolina this year to try to find the culinary treasures in the state, and you've been sharing those discoveries from time to time with us. Before we go to those of us who want to just settle in the house, you have been out looking for restaurants, too. So, and you have one for those who may be in the Triangle this weekend who care to eat out. What's your pick this time?
It is called The Barbecue Joint. And the thing that I love the most about it is that it is nothing like what it sounds like. It was such a surprising place to me. Number one, there is only one barbecue dish on the menu. Number two, it is in a strip mall. And number three, they do things like make their own confit. They make a pastrami sandwich and they cure their own pastrami. They make their own sausage. And all of this is done in a very big open space with really kind of ratty bamboo shutters and a deli counter in the center. It just is nothing like what it looks like to eat there, and I so appreciate that about it.
So why do they call this a barbecue joint? Because, you know, in North Carolina, that's high religion.
Exactly.
You know, and there is a certain taste we have in mind, and I have to say, you know, confit, which is French. What is that precisely?
Confit is actually a French method of preserving meat in its own fat, and it's usually used with duck and goose.
And it looks like kind of a golden jelly.
Exactly.
A jello,
it's
right?
A bit gelatinous.
Okay. So why do they name such a place Barbecue Joint, and why are they doing these other things there?
Well, nominally, they do serve barbecue, and the pork barbecue is really pretty good, and they have a pretty decent catering business doing that. But the two guys who own it are actually kind of closet gourmands, and they have lots of bigger interests. So I think that they're using their restaurant, you know, they do have barbecue, but then they're also making their own pickles and doing all kinds of other unusual things on the side, and the on the side suddenly became a lot bigger than the main event, I think is the case with the restaurant. Mm. And what about it appealed to me so much is that it's the kind of place where regular people who live in the Triangle go to eat. It is not a marquee restaurant. It's not a restaurant that's going to appear in too many travel guides. And yet everything there is homemade and really made with care.
Yeah. Yeah. So what kind of tablecloths do they have? Cloth? Is it paper? What?
Oh, no. Tablecloths. No. They're kind of wooden booths. They're really high back. They're a little bit uncomfortable. But You know what? I can tell you eating there is absolutely worth it just for the duck confit salad alone, which is, again, the last thing you'd expect to find in a place called The Barbecue Joint with local goat cheese and dried apricots sprinkled in.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I wonder if they serve slaw aside the confit?
They do. No, not – well, not also on the menu, not with the confit.
Okay. You can put it there if that's what you're that's your leaning. Eh? Now, do they have any kind of dessert?
They do. And, you know, one of the things I love about the place is that they make really old-fashioned Southern desserts. The last time I was there was a gigantic white layer cake that looked like a snowball with layers of marmalade in between, cream cheese frosting. It was perfect. But it was really like Ladies' Home Journal 1940s. I mean, it was a perfect old Southern cake.
That's great. Okay, so that's The Barbecue Joint. And it's in what town? And
it's in Chapel Hill on Weaver Dairy.
Okay. Now, if people are planning to stay in this weekend and store up energy for the holidays or bake cookies, what kind of desserts would you recommend they make?
Well, I'll tell you, this is it. I mean, this is cookie baking season, high cookie baking season for people who want to do that. And my favorite are really, really simple butter cookies. And my favorite of those is a cookie called Buttergebäck. It's a traditional German butter cookie. It's a lot like shortbread, and short in baking means has a lot of butter in the dough. But the ones that I like the best are a little bit flakier. They rise a little bit higher, and you can decorate them. I mean, the great thing about butter cookies is you can decorate them however you want or not at all. You know, get some great cookie cutters and cut them out, or frost them, or use a really nice confectioner's sugar. So, I mean, that's the best way to do it to me if you're going to stay in and bake cookies and be a part of that tradition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we will post that recipe on the website, so we won't have you have to jot down the instructions very quickly right now. But you do have a tip there about... this is best done if you make it in advance and then put it in the fridge.
One of the greatest things about making butter cookies is that that dough can be refrigerated for up to 4 days. So it gives you a lot of time. You can make the dough in advance, chill it, and the dough is better upon chilling. You should refrigerate it for at least 1 day before baking them off. But it gives you plenty of time. And the recipe that I like the best that we're putting on the site also includes a bunch of fruity white wine, which kind of gives the cookie a little bit more character than your regular standard butter cookies.
You're adding the wine to the cookie recipe.
Yes.
Really?
And so they go better with wine also as a result.
Okay. What is it about chilling it first that... What happens there? Why is that better than just, you know, doing up the dough and then popping it in the oven?
It's the same principle as chilling a pie crust before you bake it. Basically, what you want to do is allow the butter to get as cold as possible so it behaves better when you bake it off. And it allows the butter and the flour to kind of form better together, to marry themselves better together, if you will.
Oh, okay. Now, this is party season, and sometimes when people get invited to something, they say, what can I bring? And they don't say, bring a bottle of wine. They say, oh, bring a dessert.
Bring dessert,
which
right.
is just like, that would set me into a panic because, as I've described, I don't bake. But if somebody were to say, bring a dessert, what would you recommend?
Well, you know what, Melinda? I do bake, and those words send me into total panic.
Okay.
Because you know what? Around this time of year, everybody's really busy, and the last thing that you want to do is really spend tons and tons of time in front of the range when you've got lots of other stuff to do. But there's a couple of tricks I like to do. I really like to bring cake. I'm a cake person. I think if you bring somebody a cake, you have a friend for life. People are so appreciative of that. I love bundt cakes. They could not be easier, and there's something so old-fashioned in 50s about them. And so, you know, that's one really simple thing. Another thing is, instead of making apple pie, make apple cobbler. You don't have to go to the expense and time of making a dough, but you can still bring a lovely fruit dessert. And the toppings, even if you don't do a traditional biscuit, you can use oatmeal and ground nuts. That's even easier, and you're still bringing a great homemade dessert. It's just cutting your time in half.
So in other words, instead of dealing with the dough and making it rolled out and fit in the pie pan, you're talking about just the cobbler is
exactly.
not...
I'm talking about putting some oats, some ground nuts, and some butter into the Cuisinart and then topping the fruit with that. It's lovely and it's very easy.
Oh, great. So what have you made this season?
Oh, my gosh. You know, my big thing this season is I'm having a... I am Jewish, my husband is not, and one of my great pleasures is making Christmas dinner because I didn't grow up doing that, and I'm making venison this year, so I'm actually on a very savory wavelength at the moment.
Okay. Well, Kelly Alexander, thanks for being with us, and happy holiday.
Thank you. You too.
Kelly Alexander is the far-flung correspondent and senior editor for Sevre magazine. She joins us regularly to talk about food and the culture of food. The cookie recipe she shared with us is also available on the State of Things page on our website. That's WUNC.org. Well, if you saw the 1987 movie Lethal Weapon, that's the one with Mel Gibson and Danny Glover, the one that got that whole series started, you may well remember the mayhem, the car chases, the shoot-em-ups. But you may not remember this scene.
Once more with feeling on three. One letter. Damn it, Cooley. Do it on three. Or go on the screen.
Okay,
Silent night.
Well, that's from the Los Angeles Police precinct there. The movie Lethal Weapon does take place at Christmas time, and in addition to cops singing Christmas carols, there are action scenes around Christmas trees and car chases along the streets of L.A., those streets being adorned with Christmas and holiday lights. And here to talk with us about other movies you might not have expected to find on a list of holiday favorites is Matt Panacci. He is Director of Operations at the Carolina Theater in Durham. Welcome back to The State of Things, Matt.
Thanks for having me, Melinda. Yeah. Happy holidays.
And to you, too.
Thank you.
To you, too. Now, that was one of the movies you picked as being something that people might not expect as a Christmas movie. And what we're after here is something other than what gets shown at Christmas so often on TV. You know, the It's a Wonderful Life. And now A Christmas Story. So to you, what qualifies as a holiday movie?
Well, when I set out to do this, I wanted to try to compile a list of holiday movies that are fairly atypical, films that may be set around Christmas or use Christmas as a backdrop to a strong extent, but maybe not considered the traditional Christmas classics that we've seen a million times around the holiday seasons. And I'm not saying anything disparaging about films like A Christmas Story or Miracle on 34th Street or It's a Wonderful Life. Those are great pictures, and you should definitely see those. But when we think about Christmas, I mean, there are a bevy of other Christmas films that are not frequently thought of. In addition to Lethal Weapon, other action pictures that take place around Christmas are the huge box office hit Die Hard with Bruce Willis and the James Bond film On Her Majesty's Secret Service, which is an interesting film in that franchise, not only because it was the only appearance of George Lazenby as Bond, but it was the only Bond picture in which Bond had a wife, played by Diana Rigg, who many of you may remember from The Avengers.
Absolutely.
And of course, since Bond has a wife in that picture and she doesn't have a picture wife in any other films in the series, we can pretty much figure out what happened to her in that film. But it's an interesting footnote in that particular franchise of films.
Right. Well, you know, there is another movie that has scenes taking place at Christmas time and not thought of it as a Christmas movie per se, but perhaps something that folks might want to rent during the holidays, and that's Hope and Glory. This was a John Borman movie from the late 80s.
Absolutely. Hope and Glory is a wonderful film. John Borman has been behind the camera on many wonderful films. And again, it's not something you may think about as a Christmas film when you set out to find a film to watch around the holidays, but it's definitely a film that's well worth seeking out. It's about a family's struggles at the end of World War I, I believe.
World War II.
And another good film set during World War II about the holidays is A Midnight Clear, the 1992 film from Keith Gordon, which didn't find a huge audience upon its initial release, but is well worth seeking out.
And we'll get to The Midnight Clear in a moment, but right now, why don't we play a track from Hope and Glory? And here's a scene that we have. This is a family in England during World War II. The father's in the military. He's home on leave. And he produces a gift. It's this large, somewhat rusty can that he sets on the kitchen table.
What's that?
Jam.
Jam! 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 Jam!
Jam? What kind of jam? It's not like any jam I know.
German jam. It's German jam. Well, it's all right. Came from a German ship. Got sunk. This stuff washed ashore. Great of it. Jam. Our boys found it on the beach by the rifle range.
We don't know anything about it.
Well, it's off ration, we know that.
Well, how do we know they didn't plant it there? They know we are mad on jam. They could poison half the country.
That's from the John Borman movie, Hope and Glory. And it also has a Christmas scene in it, which is why we included it in this list, where I believe there's the Christmas dinner and everybody is seated around the table wearing those little tissue paper hats. That come in Christmas crackers.
That's correct. I actually haven't seen Hope and Glory in probably 10 to 12 years, but just listening to that clip reminded me of what a good film it is. So that might be something I'll be seeking out in the next couple of weeks to revisit. John Borman sure has made several good films in his career.
No, and Midnight Clear, that was a movie that was about a cessation of hostilities between small bands of American and British soldiers.
That's correct. A small group of German soldiers and American soldiers encounter each other around the Yuletide season, and they both come to a consensus, and that consensus is both of them feel like the war is going to end soon, and why should anyone die, particularly around Christmas? So they are able to make an agreement that they will stage a firefight, but there will be no casualties because it's just not the right thing to do. They don't feel like each of their government's ideals are worth dying for at Christmas. And it's really a very powerful film, very well executed by Keith Gordon. And for any of you who are wondering who Keith Gordon is, Keith Gordon played the son in Back to School, and he played Angie Dickinson's son in Dressed to Kill. He was just one of these character actors that was a very good young actor and played a lot of nerdy roles, but later gravitated into directing films, and he made A Chocolate War, and then he made A Midnight Clear, which was his second film, and it's definitely well worth seeking out.
Right. Now, there is another movie set during the holiday season. One might say it's much more pagan than Christian, Eyes Wide Shut.
Absolutely. Eyes Wide Shut is the final film from Stanley Kubrick, who's one of my favorite filmmakers. And I get this reaction with Eyes Wide Shut all the time. I know a large percentage of people dislike the film, to strongly dislike the film. But Eyes Wide Shut, to me, has a lot of layers, and it's one of Kubrick's films that I like it a little more every time I see it. And I think the great thing about Stanley's works is he did make multi-layered films, and he often said a lot of times when his films came out, they didn't necessarily get great reviews. For example, most people don't remember that The Shining was trashed when it came out because, in his own words, he made films with multiple layers, and you know, asking critics and audiences alike to go visit it 2, 3, 4 times is just not something that's common in the industry. They want to be one and done. But this is definitely an interesting juxtaposition against the holiday season, particularly the nature of this story.
Right. And you also have some recommendations of films in, you love horror movies. We've talked to you before about that. And there's, you talked about one called, is it Black Christmas?
Black Christmas is a great thriller. And the interesting thing about Black Christmas is it was directed by Bob Clark. Now, most people think Bob Clark's first and only foray into Christmas filmmaking was the 1983 film A Christmas Story. But in 1974, he made this horror picture to which films like Halloween and When a Stranger Calls owe a huge debt to. Black Christmas has kind of been forgotten. I know it's playing in New York and Los Angeles around the Yuletide season in brand new prints this year. And it's available on video, and it's definitely worth seeking out if you like a good suspenseful thriller.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and we have to throw one in for a stocking stuffer. And this is a movie, I believe it's called Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
Santa Claus Conquers the Martians, the 1958 film, which was the screen debut of a young Pia Zadora. Santa Claus Conquers the Martian falls into that category of what the hell were they thinking Christmas films, that films like Santa Claus the Movie, the 1985 dud with Dudley Moore and John Lithgow, and even Arnold's foray into Christmas cheer was with Jingle All the Way.
Yeah.
Santa Claus Conquers the Martians may be the most famous Christmas disaster film ever made.
And finally, Matt, what are you going to watch Christmas Day?
Well, to be honest, I think I'm going to watch Bad Santa again. I know it came out last year, but around the holidays, it's a cheerful time of year, and everyone loves to laugh. And even though Bad Santa is a pretty recent film, I think it's hilarious, and I think it will be a modern Christmas classic one day.
Okay. Well, Matt Panacci, thanks for talking with us
once again. Thank you very much.
Matt Panacci is Director of Operations at the Carolina Theater in Durham. You'll find his recommendations on the SOT page of our website, WUNC.org. That's also where you can find Kelly Alexander's recipes that we talked about this hour. And for today, that is the state of things. If you have a comment about the show, you can drop us an email at sot@wunc.org. Thank you, as always, for listening. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Melinda Pencava.